Welcome to another episode of Raven Conversations. I'm Joe C. Mandel, the State Public Affairs Officer for the Washington National Guard. And today I'm on drill weekend along with my fellow 341st Military Intelligence Battalion soldiers in the Washington Army National Guard. And we're joined by a group of language professionals from the 341st Military Intelligence Battalion to talk about what it is to be a language professional in the military. So we have a panel. We'll kind of go down the line and have them introduce themselves. And we'll start with you, Chief.
Hi, my name is Albert Schott. I've been in the National Guard for 23 years. I'm a Japanese linguist. So my background is I'm half Japanese. My mother's Japanese. So I grew up speaking conversational Japanese, but didn't have much formal training in it until I went to college. I graduated from the University of Puget Sound. And after that, I went to Japan and worked for 3 years on the JET program. And then after that, when I got back from Japan, I was in between jobs, and an old friend of ours who was an Army recruiter talked me into joining the National Guard, and the rest is history. So,
good afternoon, sir. My name is Staff Sergeant Chris Amaya. I'm originally from New York. Both my parents are from Honduras, and so that's kind of where my language background comes from as well. I speak Spanish. I graduated high school from in New York, but I actually did 5 years of school in Honduras as well. So as a teenager, I was in Honduras, and then I came back to finish my senior year in New York. And from there, tried community college for a little bit, and then decided to join the Army on the active side first, and eventually made my way over to the best side, the National Guard side.
Sergeant Stewart?
Yeah, Staff Sergeant Brandon Stewart with Alpha Company in the 341st, Japanese linguist. I, unlike the chief, I went to DLI for my language. It's a 16-month program down there in beautiful Monterey in California. There's a lot to do down there other than learn your language, so it's a lot of work but a lot of fun to attend DLI for your language studies.
Yeah, and they kind of talked about how they found out about the Guard. How did you find out about the Guard?
I found out about the Guard when I came home from my honeymoon ages upon ages ago, about 11 years ago, I want to say, and a random call from a recruiter because I had on a whim signed, sought information on the Guard's website, and he called me up, and I had had shoulder surgery in college wrestling, so I didn't think I could do it, and he said, no, it's actually a very easy waiver to get, and once all the paperwork is filed, you can go off to basic and do your job.
Where'd you wrestle at?
I wrestled at Yakima Valley Community College and then tore my shoulder up about 4 weeks into the season at Portland State.
Oh.
And then I coached the wrestling club out at Eastern Washington University.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Well, thanks for joining us. And Sam, going to end with the last best language for last.
So. Yeah. Samantha Cantrell, also in the 341st, a Thai linguist, which is great, became interested in the National Guard. How many years ago now? How long I've been in? Time flies. So I don't know, about 12 years or something. And I was interested in the National Guard. I was just working in food service, looking for something a little more interesting and a little different than that. For Thai language, I really didn't know much about it, but we've got the Washington State Partnership Program. So I was interested in working with them. So just that partnership between Washington State, the Army National Guard, and the Air National Guard, and the Thai military. So we've worked with the Thai Army and the Thai Air Force at this point. So.
Yeah. So the 341st, we're all part of the unit. It's a linguist unit. So for those that don't know, what does that mean and what is a language professional in the military?
Who wants to take that one?
I think
I'll take it. Okay, so a language professional is going to be somebody who's looked at as the subject matter expert for that language. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to know everything about that language because, I mean, no matter how much we study, there's always going to be technical aspects of the language that we don't know. But we should know where to find that information. And not only should we be the subject matter experts for the language, we also have to be the experts for cultural interaction because there's a lot of differences between Japanese culture and American culture. So when we have some kind of cultural exchange, for example, our troops are going over there, we want to advise them on what they should and should not do. Likewise, if we have Japanese soldiers coming over here, we want to be able to interact with them and not offend anybody. So those are all aspects of a language professional.
Yeah, and Chief kind of set us up so you guys can see it, you know, at home. We've got food on the table. We'll go down the line. Chief, tell us what you brought.
So, I brought sushi, okay? This is Japanese sushi here. This is actually locally made, obviously. This is typically what you would find at a Japanese sushi place with basically the raw fish, in this case salmon, and this is tuna on top of rice. This is some kind of maki, in this case nori maki. Nori is seaweed, so wrapped in seaweed. So that's very typical. This is Americanized sushi, which has all the sauces poured on top. I've never seen this in Japan. Not to say that it doesn't exist, but I personally have not seen it, but this is Americanized, so if you like that, that's fine. So typically, we would eat this with soy sauce, make a dipping sauce, put some soy sauce in there, and Japanese horseradish, wasabi, and that's how you do that. Okay.
Yeah, and then, Sergeant Stewart, you also brought sushi being a Japanese linguist?
I did. I brought a lot of Americanized sushi. To the Chief's point, I think that a lot of the sauces on top comes because they're mayonnaise-based. We end up with that American-style culture influencing the food that we take in, even from other cultures.
Yeah. And sorry, Maya, you brought some Honduras food?
I brought some food straight from Honduras. I flew in this morning. So this right here, it's called a baleada. And in Honduras, it's the typical dish. You can eat it in the mornings and the afternoons. Usually in the mornings, a little bit more leaner. The ingredients are a little bit less. In the afternoon, you could start adding maybe some meats and some chorizo maybe. So what I have here is the typical kind of like the starter dish, and it will be just a flour tortilla with refried beans and a white kind of an aged cheese, whole milk based aged cheese. And for toppings, I brought some cilantro, some onions, some guac, and if you really want to make it spicy, we have some jalapenos here. Honduran food is not typically spicy, but you can make it spicy. And we use this, kind of like this pickled onion, kind of just, it's like pickled onions with maybe some carrots in there. And it's just like this liquidy stuff, but and it could get spicy. But in lieu of that, I just brought some Mayan salsa. I got this. Actually, I take that back. My wife got it. She helped me out. My wife got it at the store, and it's just a yucateco. It's like a Mayan-based or a Mayan-named chili habanero salsa. So, again, not typically spicy, but if we want to make it spicy today, I just brought this to help me. But, yeah, baleada, straight from Honduras, and that's what I brought today, sir.
Yeah, and then Sam, no Thai food today, but that, I mean, we talked about Thai food takes a lot of space. It's a pretty, it also takes a lot to cook. Talk about that difference between food in Thailand versus how we have Thai food in America, right? I mean, it's not the same.
No, it's not quite the same. Thai food in America tends to be a little less spicy and a little bit sweeter to fit an American palate, and typically doesn't have as many sour ingredients. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
That's about all there is to it.
Yeah, a lot more fish, I think,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, a lot more fish. We got a lot of the curries here are going to be a lot less spicy for sure. And, yeah.
Yeah. So this, we usually don't pause in the middle of a, you know, podcast, but I think it's only fitting. We kind of spread the food around, and as we have a conversation, enjoy a meal.
Absolutely.
So start from there. And napkins down here if anybody needs napkins.
Okay.
Buen provecho, everyone. It's just bon appetit. So have a good meal.
Buen provecho.
What we eat, we'll kind of start, you know, what kind of led you guys to becoming language professionals? Sergeant Stewart's laughing, so we're going to pick on him first.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah, this is actually kind of one of my favorite stories to tell in the Guard. I got through basic training for my first MOS, my first job, and got to my unit. One of the first things they told us after the wildfire missions that year, because I basically landed on ground with my unit, and immediately, a couple months later, wildfire missions. And then almost immediately after that, they told us that the Guard was going to be, that unit was going to be reorganized into a striker unit, and our support staff were not needed as much, so I got to keep my very large bonus and move to a unit of my choice. They had a whole career fair, and I basically went directly to the 341st and said, that was one of the two jobs I wanted to do, but you guys didn't have a bonus at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I shifted right on over and waited for my chance to go to language school.
Nice. Mm-hmm. My story, I was actually coming in as an MP, military police, and my recruiter at the time, the recruiting station down in Brooklyn, New York, they had a like a Thanksgiving kind of dinner for recruiters and the new recruits, kind of just, you know, kind of mingle a little bit. And so a recruiter that I had never met asked me if I spoke Spanish and if I could read and write, and I said, yeah, I actually went to school in Honduras for, you know, in my teenage years. And he was like, have you ever thought about taking the DLPT, the language test, you know, that test your skill in the language that you speak? I said no. So he actually spoke to my recruiter and told him, don't let him join as an MP, and have him Monday morning, first thing, take the Spanish DLPT. And so I did. I got a satisfactory score. And from there, it was just pretty streamlined. I was pretty much slotted to be a Spanish linguist before I even signed an Army contract. Again, this was on the active side a little while ago. So I'm not sure if they still do it this way. That's something that we can definitely find out if anyone's interested. But that's how I got slotted straight into Spanish. And then because I was proficient in Spanish from the very beginning, I actually skipped DLI. Right, the Defense Language Institute, I skipped that because I didn't have to learn a language anymore. Instead, I came in as an E4, as a specialist. That was kind of like the trade-off. Mm-hmm. You're saving us money and sending you to DLI, so you come in as an E4. And as a lot of us know, usually when you come in as a specialist E4, as that pay grade, you usually have a degree. And I was just some kid off the street out of Queens, New York. So that's how that happened, sir.
Sam, you want
to? Sure. Yeah, I mean, first I got interested in the Guard before I knew what the linguists were even an option. So I ended up talking to a Guard recruiter and just going over the options in Washington State. And with 341st being so prolific, I ended up scoring high enough on my ASVAB to be qualified for a linguist position. They allowed me to take the D-Lab, and I scored high enough for language. There's, you know, the different categories of languages. And I was lucky enough to score high enough to be able to study Thai. I didn't really know a whole lot about Thailand, but I just knew I wanted to go to language school. It sounded like a great time, right? You get to spend a year doing nothing but just studying language. And to me, that sounded like a really, really good time. So that's what got me into language first and then Thai. And so once I got into researching a little bit about Thailand, and especially once I went to school and met my instructors and learned about the culture, definitely fell in love with the language and the culture. Like, great food, great people. So it's been a great time and a great experience for sure.
Nice. Yeah. Gee, I don't know if you want to share how you got into it. It kind of sounds like you were born and raised into it.
Sure, yeah. So in my case, again, yeah, my mother was Japanese. So I grew up, you know, speaking conversational Japanese. But I grew up in the military. So my father and mother met when my father was stationed in Japan there. But so I went straight into college, graduated from college, started working, and to be honest, I always kind of felt bad that I hadn't served myself. So after coming back from working in Japan, the family friend of ours, who was a military recruiter, he said, hey, since you don't have a job yet, do you have any interest in possibly joining the Guard? And, you know, you can use your Japanese language. And at that time, I really didn't know anything about the Guard or that I could use Japanese in the Guard. So I started going through the process, and just like you, I took the DLPT. Ended up scoring high enough that I didn't get a chance to go to DLI, yeah. Which, in hindsight, DLI is a great place, I hear, but it's down in Monterey, California. I didn't get a chance to go. But anyway, yeah, so I did that, and I joined in 2000, and right when I was finishing all of my training is when 9/11 happened. So after that, the Guard kind of became a full-time deal for me, so I stayed in.
Yeah, and so you guys have already started using some terms that we were going to ask about later, but DLPT. So what is a DLPT?
The DLPT is the Defense Language Proficiency Test. So they have tests in each of the specific languages, and you sit down and you take that test. Nowadays, it's all on computer, and when you go through, they have a listening section and then a reading section, and then depending on how high you score on that, you can even qualify to get a language bonus. So in other words, you can get paid for your language.
And then D-Lab.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. The let's see if I remember this. The Defense Language Aptitude Battery. And what I think it amounts to is fake language that you try and memorize a few rules really quickly. And how well you do that determines your aptitude.
And then DLI. You said DLI. And you went to West and Monterey, as they've kind of mentioned. And you said you went to East. So
yes.
Kind of talk about the differences.
I guess the biggest difference is DLI West was like the first one where they said, we need to have a language to fight the Japanese, oddly enough. Which is why Japanese is the first and oldest language at DLI, but also has kind of a small class size because it's not a defense priority language, or I'm not sure if I have that term correct, but the ones that we might have conflict with.
Mm-hmm.
Strong allies, so we need to work with them. We want to work with them, I should say. And so that's why Japanese is still one of the primary languages there. But as far as the campus goes, it's right there on the California shore. Beautiful views that you get to see right before you walk into 7 strong hours of nothing but language and cultural studies. It's really a unique experience. Beyond the word of unique.
I've heard it's intense. It, like the study, the curriculum, the
mostly they
the
do
tempo.
It in buildings, not tents, but yeah.
It is. We got jokes
really
here today.
It really is an intense program, like you say, where if you are making all your tests and everything, then they encourage you to do 0 hour, and then you have 6 hours of class study. Whereas if you're a little bit behind in your studies, they'll mandate you have the 0 hour where you're one-on-one more, and at the end of the day, you might get some extra one-on-one time with a professor.
And I assume DLI East is very similar in structure, just a different place.
It's actually quite different because there's no actual campus. That's just like DLI.
Mm-hmm.
So they have an office in Alexandria that you're assigned to, but you go to a contract language school. And that's kind of an important distinction because the professors are contractors, they aren't professors. But the expectations are the same. You're putting in the same amount of hours, you're studying the same curriculum, and at the end of, you still have the same standard for the DLPT. And the instructors, I'm sure, are just as dedicated to student success. But it's definitely a slightly less regimented experience. We wore civilian clothes most days. And we didn't really have any mandatory homework hours or anything like that. But they definitely still had high expectations for us.
You
that comes
make
with that
grade
independence.
No matter what.
Yeah. So it's a little bit different. But that difference is important, too, because DLI in Monterey, from what I understand, you can get a degree there. So it's accredited. Where DLI on the East Coast, still great experience, but I don't think you have those education benefits the same way.
Yep. If you are able to satisfy the extra work, the core classes that you would need for an AA degree prior to leaving DLI, or even after you leave DLI, then you can, as long as you're language proficient, you can have the DLI issue an associate's in your language.
Nice. And so we got a nice mix of native speakers and those that were not native speakers but went to school for it. But the standard qualifications for being a language professional are across the board exactly the same for you guys all, right?
Correct.
What does that standard qualification look like to be a qualified linguist?
You'll have to score.
And get the language pay, which we'll get into here in a minute.
Yeah.
Can we take a pause before answering that question? I don't want to disturb it, but that food is fantastic.
Thank
you for bringing it.
Yes.
And that is doing the job.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yes.
I feel my...
Napkins over there.
Yeah.
I feel
my
nose starting to feel the heat a little bit. I just wanted to take a pause.
Yeah, not typically spicy food. Again, you know, it's just I had to compete with the Japanese food over here. I know the wasabi, you know, can get you.
Anyway, sorry.
Oh, all good.
Yeah.
So the standard qualifications as we were talking about, and what that looks like for the language pay and incentive pay, which we'll get into here in another question.
The standard qualification would be a 2 in listening and 2 in reading. That's the standard, and that's what gets you your pay bonus, your language bonus. However, there are different tiers. So if you're a 2-2, that's one set of, amount of pay. And then if you go up to a 2+, or a 3, then it goes up. There's also the OPI, which is a oral, more of like a, not really a test, it's more like an interview. And if you're able to score, from my understanding, you have to score at least a 3-3 in order to qualify to take an OPI. That might have changed, or I might have that wrong, but if you do score, for example, a 3-3-3, you would get the maximum pay bonus, what the Army or what the Guard is offering at the time, or Big Army, I should say, is offering at that time. So 2-2, 2+, and 3 is what gets you paid. The higher you go, the more you get paid.
And are all the pay is exactly the same, no matter what language, correct? Or is there languages that get paid more based on, like, requirements and needs?
My understanding, sir, is that it used to be tiered, again, based on the potential foreseen defense need of the test, but now it's just tiered straight across based on your level of proficiency.
So kind of the meat and potatoes, you kind of already brought it, but what is the incentive pay, right? If you're a 2-2 speaker, mm-hmm. and you're what is that pay? And some of you are like, hey, I don't know, because I've been a 3-3 forever, I can't remember.
We don't want more people joining and taking our money. No, I'll be the example. For a 3-3-3, I have a 3 in reading, 3 in listening, and a 3 in oral interview. And so what that pay looks like for me is $900 extra a month on top of my base pay and, of course, BAH and everything else that goes along with it. But that's my language bonus, $900 extra a month, which is really nice.
That's whether you drill or not, too. Like, if we have some months where you don't drill, you still end up getting that language bonus, which is really nice. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're a student or something, mm-hmm. it's great.
Yeah, and it requires you to maintain it at that specific
right,
level.
Right, because it is an incentive.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, my next CLPT is going to be in July this year, and for sure I'm going to absolutely try to be at the top of my game because that's the incentive. You know, I don't want to go down in pay, and so that makes me, in all honesty, it makes me a better linguist. It makes me study. It makes me start looking into courses, classes, whether that's online or in person. It makes me want to dig deeper into the culture of the language and, you know, learning the differences of how every Spanish-speaking country speaks Spanish. You know, like, it just gets me more in tune with everything all around. So big incentive and a big payday, honestly.
And how often do you have to take the test?
Right now, if you are a 3-3 to the bare minimum, they're giving you, you can test every 2 years. Before, it used to be every year. So now I test every 2 years, as long as I keep my 3-3.
Yeah. So kind of the big question, right? Because obviously there's an incentive to it. You want to maintain your language as the best you can. What is the easiest and hardest part of maintaining your languages?
So maintaining the language takes a lot of work. And fortunately, in this area, we have a lot of language resources. So me being a Japanese linguist, I have Japanese people that live around here, so I'm able to speak conversationally with them. There's actually a Japanese language channel that I'm able to subscribe to, so I do that. So I'm able to maintain my listening very well. The reading, I have to buy my own textbooks and such, but yeah, I just work on that. And then nowadays, it's gotten so much easier because we have YouTube. The language resources that are available online, you can bring up YouTube and watch native speakers, you know, give you instruction and hear conversational stuff. So honestly, it's gotten a lot easier than it used to be, but it's still difficult. It still takes time and effort.
Anybody else kind of?
When it comes to maintaining language, it is hard, especially as somebody who got to the language. I think I went to DLI at, how old was I? I think it was 34 when I went to DLI. And so to input that into my daily life, to just do a little bit of practice, just 5 minutes a night. My brother loves to tell me, you know, you can pick up guitar really fast if you just do it for 5 minutes a night. I'm like, yeah, but I'm doing language for 5 minutes a night, chemistry for 5 minutes a night, biology for 5 minutes a night. Fitting in that extra study outside of going back to school is hard, but like you said, it is well worth it. To create a little space in your income as well.
Yeah, maybe this is more of a question for you guys, not being native speakers, but high school requirements, right, was to have a foreign language, at least in the state of Washington, right? Yeah. And usually it's Spanish, and it's one that's like you go to class, you learn a few phrases, and that's about it. Do you find it's easier to pick up a language? I mean, were you able to pick up a language in high school when you were younger and that kind of thing?
I won't say I took my French super seriously because I did 4 years to get 2 free years of college credit out of it. But French jumps into my Japanese sometimes, especially when I am struggling to find a word, French will just creep in. Being cognizant of that as a multilingual person who didn't do it from a young age brings its fun and its challenges.
Yeah, I took Spanish in high school, like most people in my high school did. I think it was the only language we offered, and I loved it. It's probably what drove me to end up in language school, but always did really well in Spanish. But I found Thai to be significantly more challenging because it's tonal. It's a tonal language, and it's so different than English and Spanish. DLI was great for that, just from having a much more immersive experience in the first month. You might be going over what you'd go over in a whole semester in a high school or college class. So,
and you mentioned another term, and I'm going to throw it out there, and I think we all know what it means, immersion, right? So what is an immersion if you're a linguist?
At DLI, it was torture.
Yeah, it's diving in. It's diving into the language, diving into the culture, trying to help yourself just have everything around you in that language. And I'm sure you have... some example of that as well.
So immersion, I'm going to say it's the best way to learn a language, but it's also a very difficult way to learn a language because you throw yourself into that language and culture. So if you don't have any background in it, you're going to struggle for a little while until you can start to pick up a little bit of the words and the grammar and some things. Like the grammar between English and Japanese, some people describe it as being almost backwards, like the sentence structure. So until you figure that out, you're going to struggle in that immersion. But when you're actually living it day to day in an immersion environment, you kind of really embed that into your brain, and it lasts a long time as far as retention goes. So if you have the opportunity to go on an immersion program, I highly recommend it, but it's going to be challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think for those that are watching that either A, speak a foreign language already, they're a native speaker, or they're interested in it because they're going through high school and they're speaking there, or just somebody that's like, hey, I really want to know a foreign language, you know. What do they need to know? How do they find out more about language programs in the military and joining a unit like this?
It starts with the recruiter, I think. If you're already interested in joining the National Guard, it starts with your recruiter. Actually, there's a point that I was thinking about yesterday. And just real quick, if there's any recruiters watching, you know, just kind of get savvy on the topic of what it is to be a 35 series in the Army, what it is to be in the intelligence field, in the MI field, what it is, and then what different 35 series jobs look like, and then finally, you know, the language side, the linguist side. I know for a fact that there's some recruiters that might not know too much about it. So if you have someone that's interested in that, and just, it starts with the recruiter, right? If the recruiter doesn't have enough information, you know, then that's a loss. That's a missed opportunity, really. So I think that's where it starts, just with a recruiter. For a recruiter to get to know what's going on and get some more information on that, just really contact units, or the organization's CLPM program, the command language program manager, contact, you know, that person and get more information that way. So for someone that's interested right now, just watching this, that's where it starts. Ask the questions. Get your recruiter to really do that homework for you and put you, you know, on the right path.
Yeah. Anybody else got anything to add on that?
Yeah, if you're interested in a language, certainly if you're already in the Guard, talk to your CLPM, or if you don't have a CLPM, Lieutenant Shelton or Casey Sung, Sergeant First Class Sung, yeah, and take a DLAB, the Defense Language Aptitude Battery, and see if you can pass that, because that's going to be the first step in getting you qualified to try and go off to a language school, you know, Monterey West or East, and then, you know, possibly starting your career as a language professional.
Yeah. Anybody got anything else they want to add before we kind of close, or?
Doing good with spice over there?
No, I'm good. That had some good burn to it. As far as anything else to add, a lot of people think that the military is just going out and seeking people to unalive. But so much of this job is actually about building the bridges between our cultures, and that is how we build the bridges that can prevent the wars. And that's the really important part for me.
I think that's pretty well said. I mean, you guys are kind of at the front line of building relationships and showing other cultures, hey, we understand and we appreciate, and that, those bonds you kind of mentioned, though. So appreciate that. If you're interested in becoming a linguist and joining this incredible group of people, I've had now, I think, 15 years of being a military intelligence officer and getting to spend time with linguists, and it always amazes me. We can definitely put Chief Word, her information in the notes, Lieutenant Shelton's and Sergeant First Class Sung's. If you like the video, give it a like. If you want to know more about language stuff, put it in the comments, and we can definitely get that information for you. And make sure to subscribe for more videos. And appreciate you guys, and let's eat some more food while we're sitting here. So
I'm hungry. Thank you, sir.